they say my name when you get a
community. What finance is sending over?
Good afternoon. I'll call the order meeting. The state government budget for Monday, January 22, 2007. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum. Apologize for the delay in starting the budget division. We had a longer than expected floor session today, and so we want to give people the opportunity to get some lunch before we started the meeting here. We do have a bill on our agenda today. It is Senate File 103. Senator Higgins, welcome to the budget division. And it's my understanding that we've got a desire to get this done during the current biennium, which is why we're not looking at this part of the budget process. I understand that's Senator Higgins, welcome to the budget division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Senate File 103 does deal with the transfer of appropriations within the appropriations that we had previously done for money that came from the federal government to the state for the Help America Vote Act. When we were originally putting this into law, the legislature required the Secretary of State to have various categories that the money would be spent on. And now we find that some of those categories have no money left, and some have quite a lot of money left. So I have with me here today Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office, and she's going to give you more detail on this. And I suspect that she will refer you to the page 2 and 3 of the fiscal note.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Fraser, and I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office. As Senator Higgins was explaining, the legislature did dictate categories that money could be spent in within the $3 million that they appropriated to the Secretary's office for the fiscal year 06-07 budget. As we were handed the budget at the beginning of this month, we realized that there was no money left to improve and maintain the statewide voter registration system, which is a fairly new database put in place in 2004 to comply with the Federal Help America Vote Act. And we found that it does need quite a bit of work to bring it up to par so that the counties can use it reliably, and there are some things that could be improved as well. There were some categories where there's quite a bit of money left and no real use for the funds during the balance of fiscal year 07, so during the next 5.5 months. We have $145,000 to assist local election officials with using this system. Well, the real time that they needed this assistance was in the fall prior to the election. This isn't the time when we really need to spend these funds. Similarly, on the next page, there's $110,000 to train local election officials. Again, there's not a real use for these funds during the next 5.5 months. The other large chunk of money is the $120,000, category number 8, that was set aside to process complaints filed under the Help America Vote Act. We have had very few complaints filed and have not spent any of this money. And since the major election of this fiscal year was in November, we don't expect to receive many more in the coming months. And so what we're asking is for permission to move the money from the categories that have the dollar amount in bold, so 4, 7, 8, 10, and 11, and allow us to use it to work on the statewide voter registration system in the first three categories.
What would happen if this does not pass, or if it passes and the governor does not support it? What happens?
Mr. Chair, members, right now we have budgeted to use these funds, and so we are spending our general fund appropriation faster than we had expected because we can't access these funds. So if we can't access these funds, I think it will mean quite a bit of belt tightening during the next 5.5 months and critical work that could be done to improve the statewide voter registration system will be put on hold. During the election, we heard from counties that the statewide voter registration system was incredibly slow at peak periods. It would kick users off, that the absentee ballot module didn't work as well, and it led to counties having to do a lot of work by hand that could have been automated. With the new Department of Public Safety driver's license numbers, it's causing some problems, and we'd like to be able to reprogram it to handle the new driver's license numbers. We also, this year, worked on giving access to city and school board officials, and only a few cities and school boards have actually signed up to use that viewing option, but we want to improve that as well. So there's quite a bit of work to be done. We also, to comply with the Help America Vote Act, need to be able to verify the last four digits of individual Social Security numbers if they don't provide us with a driver's license number. And to date, we are not able to do that verification, and so that's another area where we still need to do work to come into compliance.
And perhaps I may need to ask a question of either the fiscal analyst or Senate counsel. What happens to the unencumbered balance if there is any leftover money? Does that stay within the Secretary of State's office? Does it revert the general fund? Where does it go?
It'll just remain in the fund, this special
revenue. In the special revenue fund.
Yeah. Are there any questions? There is an A3 amendment, and before we get to that, I believe that it's been the practice to have reports, or I would think notice would have to be given to the chairs and the ranking minority members if there's going to be any change in the fund balance. I think that Senator Roblin would like to know that information if something's going to happen. So I think that we may need to look at that at the A3 amendment. Is there any question for the members about the issue before us before we look at the amendment? Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that there aren't many elections held in the first half of the year, but the townships often hold elections, and a lot of them may have elected new officers in the not-too-distant past. I'm just wondering about the training provisions. Other entities may also have new people in place who are overseeing elections. Is there another appropriation to train these new people, or would we really have to depend upon this $200,000 for a long-term training amount? So I want to make sure that the new people coming in are going to have access to training.
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling, that's a great question. And we are fully committed to spending the time and energy and funds necessary to provide adequate training for local election officials on the statewide voter registration system, on the new accessible voting equipment. Townships are not required to use the new accessible voting equipment this year. That requirement doesn't kick in until January 1st, 2008. And so part of our 08-09 budget will be setting aside funds to do exactly that sort of training and making sure that everyone is comfortable with the equipment. But right now we're just looking at funds that can be spent between now and June 30th. And so I don't expect that there would be a lot of need to do training in that time period, but the language is permissive. So it says that we may use the funds for the statewide voter registration system if there is a need to use them for training or to deal with complaints. We still could do that over the next 5.5 months.
Sarah Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, this seems very unusual to me that we have this line item appropriation. It just seems very prescriptive. I would think that it would be more useful to allow the agency to transfer funds between line items as needed. You know, and then adjust that request for the next biennium. I'm sure there's a history there, but yeah. I just don't know if it's still necessary.
Does anybody know what happened, sir?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I think that was my idea. The Elections Committee was very concerned that there would be an imbalance in the spending that went on. You know, the things that maybe weren't so, maybe somebody in the system didn't think would be as important as what we did. For instance, the processing the complaints, the going online with the new voter registration system was very controversial and done in very quickly, and we just assumed that there would be some complaints. Well, it turned out that our professional staff was really good in complaints. But we wanted this was the legislature's work. We set up these categories so we made it prescriptive and.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, do you feel like you need to do that, or you want to continue with this route and then reconsider in the next budget?
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I actually still like the idea of the categories, but as we saw, they weren't spent evenly. And maybe in future deliberations in the Elections Committee, maybe they should go back to saying just listing them without an amount of money. But that's not what this bill is. This bill is just for this biennium, which expires in a few months.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Pappas.
Well, Senator Higgins, I don't want to belabor the issue, but, couldn't we do something? Does the legislature really have to be informed? And couldn't we do something simple, like allow the agency to transfer from one line item to another as needed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we could do that, but that's not what this bill does. And at this point, we're just dealing with the remaining amount for this biennium. And maybe Ms. Fraser could say it better than I am.
Well, it's a written notice. It's not a permission. So it means you send us a letter saying where you're going to switch the funds around. So, all right.
Yeah, I think given the fact that this is how it was set up for this biennium and they're asking permission to move some money around, I think we should finish off the biennium permission. The way it was set up, and maybe that'll give us some guidance as to how to look at it for the next biennium.
All right.
There is an A3 amendment, but as I say, I think it may need a little bit of modifications. And I believe, Senator Higgins, you've seen the A3 amendment. You've got a copy of it?
Mr. Chair, we have it here.
Okay. And I think that there was some concern about whether 10 days was required. I think it should still be written notice so that somebody doesn't stop one of us in the hallway and tell us something and say, well, I gave them notice. I don't know if there's that much difficulty in sending some writing out to the people who have an interest in it. Mr. Bodern, is there a way we can delete the 10 days, still require the written notice, and also require the notice to be given to the ranking members in both the House and the Senate? Mr. Bodern, do you have any suggestions?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, you can just make a short oral amendment to the amendment. On page 1, line 3 of the amendment, delete 10. And on page 1...
10 days?
Yes. Thank you. 10 days, mm-hmm. And on page 1, line 4, after chairs, insert, and the ranking minority members.
Okay. Does somebody on the Budget Division wish to move the A3 amendment as modified?
So moved.
Okay. Senator Larson moves the A3 amendment as modified. Do you wish to have it read to you again? Anybody? Discussion on the A3 amendment. Anybody wants to be heard on the A3 amendment? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Senator Higgins, do you have any other witnesses? Or is that? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sure, I think that's just us.
Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 103 as amended? Appears to be done. The bill, like anything out of this budget division, will have to go to the Finance Committee. Is there a motion then?
So moved.
Okay. Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 103, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. Then we have, we asked the legislative auditor to discuss their report on tax compliance and then hear from the Department of Revenue on their tax compliance initiative. So typically we do have oversight over that part of the revenue budget, even though the tax committee sometimes shows an interest in it. This has historically been in our area too. So who is here? I guess we have Deborah Parker Junod from
Junod.
Junod, I'm sorry.
Welcome. Mr. Chair. We're waiting for our technology here to boot up a little bit to help me along with my presentation. I'm right-handed, so I'm going to sit a little bit over on this side here.
Whatever works for you, go ahead.
As you know, Mr. Chair, the Office of the Legislative Auditor released a report on tax compliance last year, and I am Deborah Parker Junod. I was the project manager on this evaluation, and I'm here today just to give you some background and to highlight some of the findings from that evaluation before you hear from the Department of Revenue about their tax compliance initiatives. I'll just give you a summary of our major report findings. Please, you know, feel free to interrupt me with any questions. Can you see that pretty well now?
Yes.
Okay.
I can.
Our evaluation focused on two tax types. We looked at the individual income tax and the sales and use tax, which account for about three-quarters of the state's tax revenue. Just to remind you, the use tax is pretty much like the sales tax, but it applies to purchases made from out of state. For example, internet sales or catalog sales or other sales made from out-of-state vendors. Oop, hang on here. Can we get the computer to go? Let's try that one. You should have a handout for my presentation. Kathleen, maybe you could help out on this a little bit to get it, see if we can get it going again. You should have a copy of our presentation that has various slides. Seem to be locked up here, not moving up. Oh, there we go. Okay, which one? This one? All right. The Department of Revenue itself has estimated what the tax gap is, and that is the estimate of how much is there a difference between what taxpayers should pay and what they actually do pay. And the amount that you see on the screen here is what the Department of Revenue established that taxpayers were supposed to pay for the income tax and the sales and use tax for the years noted. The studies also estimated, based on census and other data for both tax types, that not everybody pays what they owe. For example, for the individual income tax, they estimated that the tax gap is about $600 million. And for the sales and use tax, it's about $450 million. What else do we know about these tax gaps? First, for the income tax gap, most of the income tax gap is from people who file returns but underreport their income. And the vast majority of this is non-wage income, particularly from people who are self-employed. Another $124 million is from people who don't file tax returns at all, and we call them non-filers. Businesses and individuals who do not pay use tax account for $272 million of the tax gap. Most of this is owed by businesses, not individuals. And also, businesses who don't collect and remit the right amount of sales tax account for about another $180 million of the tax gap. So together, that counts for about $1 billion in tax that is owed but not paid. But let me emphasize right now that not all of this is collectible tax, and we're going to come back and talk about that issue a little bit more later. So what does the Department of Revenue do to collect or to try to improve tax compliance? First, they educate and assist taxpayers, trying to help taxpayers understand what their responsibilities and their obligations are. They try to identify taxpayers who are noncompliant. They help audit tax returns. They collect payments that are due. And they also try to simplify the tax system. So there's an entire cycle of tax compliance activities that need to be undertaken. What do we conclude overall? We focused primarily on assistance, auditing, and collection of activities. First, we think the department is employing sound strategies. You know, that compliance cycle, that's a cycle that's used nationally. It's by the IRS. It's been, you know, validated, I think, on a national scale. So we think that their strategies are sound. But we think that there are a number of areas where the department can improve its implementation of strategies. First, we think they can do a better job providing timely assistance to taxpayers who call for help. For example, in the 2005 income tax filing season, the department answered about 67% of incoming calls. They also provided limited assistance for non-English speakers who call and ask for help. I'm not going to focus too much on this for the rest of my presentation, but I would urge you to look in chapters 2 and 3 of the report. And at the end of the report, we also list out a number of recommendations that cover assistance and education. And even though I'm going to give a little bit of short shrift from here on these issues, I do want you to understand that we think they're very important components of any tax compliance strategy. Next, we think the department can fine-tune its audit programs to improve their impact. They need better data for identifying taxpayers who are noncompliant, and they need to do a better job of collecting taxes due from people who know they owe, and the department knows who owe money, but they're not paying on time. I'm going to start with auditing. First, you know, what should a good audit program encompass? We think at first, and this is obviously an interest of the legislature, it should raise revenue. Next, it should target components of the tax gap. That is, it should be focusing on those taxpayers who are most likely to be noncompliant. And finally, it should encourage voluntary compliance. That is, it should educate taxpayers who are being audited about what they were supposed to be doing so that they'll continue to, you know, be compliant in the future. And the department should also do enough audits to create a deterrent effect to those who perhaps are willfully noncompliant. So are the department's audits resulting in additional tax dollars for the state? And in fact, yes, they are. On average, we estimated that a dollar spent on income tax auditing and collection, that means bringing the money in the door, you know, not just making an assessment, but bringing it in, those income tax audits yielded about $6.70 per dollar invested. For the sales and use tax, these investments yielded about $5.40 per dollar invested. But please keep in mind, these estimates do not include any estimate on future voluntary compliance. Those impacts could be substantial. We just simply can't estimate them. And also, let me also point out, I think relevant to the discussion that will follow, our estimates include the department's overall compliance activities. We did not segregate the, you know, impact of the tax compliance initiatives from any sort of baseline tax compliance. Our estimates are for the department's overall tax compliance activities, generally, you know, covering fiscal years 04 and 05. But we do think, though, that those averages mask some big variations. And let me give you a couple of examples why we think some tax programs were better than others. First, the percentage of audits that resulted in no change to tax due is high. For example, 34% of income tax face-to-face audits, those are the ones where the tax auditor actually meets generally with the taxpayer. About 34% of those audits yield no change in tax due, and that's about twice the rate of the IRS no change rate for similar types of field audits. And that suggests that the department can improve the way it selects returns for those face-to-face audits. Second, the department continued to put some resources into audit projects that identified little noncompliance relative to the investment being made. And again, this issue isn't just about short-term revenue yield. Voluntary compliance, again, is the big kahuna here. That's what we're after. And the more well-targeted audits are, the more likely they're going to have an impact on future voluntary compliance. Another objective of auditing is to target major components of the tax gap. And as a refresher, I've just put on the screen here what those major components are, and I'm going to talk just a little bit about each of those. Overall, the department has made good progress, I think, directing compliance towards non-filers in the individual income tax area. They've really ramped up the audits they've done each year, and the additional tax assessments have grown from around $15 million to about $28 million a year. But again, remember that assessments, that means, you know, how much the tax auditor thinks is due to the state, that's not the same as money in the door. And in fact, non-filer assessments are very hard to collect, and the department has had a hard time bringing these dollars from past due assessments in the door. But, you know, on the other side of that, the goal, I think, really of non-filer programs is to get these people into the tax compliance system and want them to file returns in future years. And really at this point, in terms of the department's data collection, the jury is still out on whether those non-filer programs are in fact helping to bring these people into long-term compliance. But, you know, that's the big goal from the non-filer program.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Sarah Robley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, is there a particular group of people that are non-filers? I've actually run into a few folks who claim that it's, you know, it's against the Constitution to require income taxes, and they've told me straightforward that they don't pay taxes. And I'm wondering if this is there a group, a fairly significant group like that, or who? What would be a profile of non-filers?
And why would they tell their legislator that?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we have just a limited bit of information. We didn't do a lot of work on profiling these people. But overall, about nearly half of the individual income tax, and that includes non-filers and underreporters, came from those with incomes over $100,000. And non-filer rates generally are higher for lower income levels, you know. But it's kind of a mixed bag. It really is a mix of higher income and lower income individuals.
And
non-wage and wage income. I think the department might be able to give you a little bit more information from their profile data on that.
And Ms. Janad, did you sense that these were all self-employed as well, too, people with those high incomes?
Mr. Chair, I think the big thing to focus on is the underreporter tax gap, which is
sure. The
biggest chunk
okay. Of
the individual income tax gap came from people who are self-employed,
sure.
Non-wage income. And the issue to think about there is that there's not much third-party wage reporting in that sector.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who have wages, there's W-2 wage reporting from other sources that say how much income that person has earned, and compliance in that tech sector is extremely high, very high in Minnesota and nationally, and according to IRS data. The bigger noncompliance problem is those who are self-employed and don't have, you know, those third-party sources telling the Department of Revenue or the IRS how much wages they've earned. So some of the struggle we have here in Minnesota is really a national struggle, and we'll talk a little bit later. I'll talk a little bit later about some federal changes, you know, that really would help address some of these key issues. But I do want to say that the problems in Minnesota are really national issues. but we still need to deal with them. You know, we still have a tax compliance problem in the state.
Just as an aside, as a lawyer, sometimes I handle divorces, and of course, you get somebody on the other side who's self-employed, and you know, it's hard to get that information too. And I said, well, if they're going to lie to the government, they're certainly going to lie to the spouse too. I mean, they just it happens that way. So, but anyway, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, it's the benefit of third-party reporting.
Right,
I think
yeah.
you've made the case
yeah.
there.
Yeah, go ahead, please proceed. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little bit. Just, you know, I already segued into this. And in our view, the department's been able to make limited progress on identifying this underreported income, you know, again, especially among the self-employed. Finding people who are hiding income requires fairly complex field audit techniques. And the department has been hiring auditors. You know, especially through funding from the legislature for compliance initiatives, but turnover has really been a major problem. And at the time that we issued our report, again, you know, that was last year, so most of our data is for 2005, the department had had a serious problem trying to maintain a critical mass of auditor staff who could do the kinds of audits that get at this hidden income.
Did you get a sense as to why that was? Or well, ask the department, but did you have any feeling as to why what the turnover?
Mr. Chair, I think the Department of Revenue has suffered from some of the issues that the Legislative Auditor's Office, if I could make a small pitch,
yeah.
has had the same issue with, and that is that state-employed auditors, really compared to the private sector market, are underpaid. And there is a competitive mm-hmm. advantage for the private sector over the public sector in this area. And both the Department of Revenue and the Office of the Legislative Auditor, who employ, you know, similar types of people, have had a major retention problem in large part because of lack of competitiveness with private sector pay. And there have been quite a few, I think, pay studies by Deed, the Revenue, and OLA that demonstrate that that is a significant issue. And I think Revenue will be able to talk about some of the Band-Aids they've been able to place on that issue, but I think there are still some long-term concerns that need to be addressed over the state's ability to retain good financial auditors.
Thank you.
All right, let me talk about one other issue. The federal government, as you know, Minnesota's income tax return is linked directly to the federal return. So from an auditing perspective, the kinds of auditing that count are state income tax auditing and federal income tax auditing. And one of the things that's hurt Minnesota is that even though as a state, Revenue has been ramping up its income tax auditing, since about 1998, 99, 2000, the federal auditing presence nationwide has been dropping precipitously. And one of the issues that we identified is that even though we were ramping up, it still hasn't kept, you know, counterbalanced the drop in federal auditing that happened over the last, you know, 5 to 8 years. Now, I know on the federal level that issue's been raised and the IRS is in fact trying to kind of build up its audit presence, but in terms of an overall compliance impact in Minnesota, you need to understand that, you know, even though the revenue department may be ramping up, you know, the federal presence has declined. And so you need to consider both of those forces at the same time. Let's talk about the sales and use tax gap. Again, here we found that the department has made limited progress targeting the sales and use tax gap. There are relatively few auditors for the number of businesses in the state, so the audit presence here is fairly low. The department does fairly little to enforce the use tax for households, which is about $75 million. But again, you know, there's a cost effectiveness issue here in this sector that I think you need to consider. But really, the big issue is that as e-commerce has been growing, the use tax problem grows with it. And a lot of the solution to this, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, has to do with federal action, not just the Department of Revenue. So there are some significant barriers to addressing the sales and use tax gap. let me shift gears just a little bit. I talked a little bit about data issues and trying to identify and target people who are noncompliant, but there are two data issues I'd like to raise with you. First is Minnesota does not participate in a program that's called the Fed State Electronic Filing Program. And this is a program where, in essence, an electronically filed Minnesota return goes through the IRS's electronic systems with the federal return so that the IRS processes our Minnesota return and puts our returns through the edits that they put federal returns through. And of 39 states with an income tax, Minnesota is one of four that does not participate in their program. There are a few downsides to it in terms of programming costs, delays of returns maybe by 1 to 3 days. But in our view, we really think that Minnesota would benefit from participating in that program so that we can benefit from the compliance reviews that the IRS does. Second, we think that the department makes ineffective use of W-2 wage and tax information. We still have about a fourth of Minnesota employers who provide these returns on paper instead of electronically, and that makes it very difficult for the department to make effective use of this information to help ensure compliance. And in fact, this is one of the areas where we made a legislative recommendation in the report. We recommend that the legislature mandate that Minnesota employers must file their W-2 wage and tax statements electronically and in a common format that would help the Department of Revenue do its compliance activities. Let me talk just before I close about one more compliance activity. It's a little bit different than the tax gap, and this is about collecting past due tax payments. There are generally two types of delinquencies that the Department of Revenue has to deal with. One is a tax return where someone essentially declares, I owe the state money, but they don't attach the check or their electronic payment. The other is a situation in which there's an audit assessment, but the taxpayer doesn't pay within 60 days. Cumulatively, at the time of our evaluation, these delinquencies were about $459 million. They came from all tax types, but about two-thirds were late income tax payments. And this inventory was growing by roughly 8% per year since fiscal year 2000. The Department of Revenue has, in fact, been collecting more each year, but that amount has not been keeping pace. You know, the increases in collections have increased by about 5% per year. That's not keeping pace with the amount of incoming delinquencies that largely arise from the ramped up income tax auditing that the state has been doing kind of at the front end or middle end. In the report, we lay out a number of factors that are impeding more efficient debt collection. First, the process itself has too many steps, too many case hands-offs. The department tends to use a one-size-fits-all approach, and we think they need to do more to tailor collection activities to the type of debtor or debt. For example, less than 10% of debtors account for 90% of the accounts receivable. And we think that the department should do more to focus on those 10% of debtors who account for the vast majority of the debt. All in all, the department is not meeting its goal to collect debts quickly. At the time we did our work, and again, these data are a year old, about 60% of the debts in inventory were more than a year old. And again, the older the debt gets, the harder it is to collect. We think the department needs some help with data systems, information systems, so that they can really dig into these processes, you know, and answer questions like, you know, when should we use this intervention for this kind of debt, and what proportion of debts get collected at this stage of the process? You know, right now they can't answer those kinds of questions. So I know this is being a little bit long. Let me start to sum up. First, let me be clear that the tax gap is not easy revenue. I think last year the press paid a lot of attention to that $1 billion number. But, you know, this year, next year, the following year, we're not going to get $1 billion from the tax gap. What it is, though, is an indicator of where the pockets of noncompliance are and where Minnesota needs to focus its resources. How can we reduce that tax gap? Part of it is legislative action. For example, mandating the e-filing of W-2 wage and tax information. How much are we going to invest as a state in simplification? Again, back to that tax compliance cycle, how much are we going to invest in simplification, assistance, auditing, and collection? Part of it depends on how well the Department of Revenue is able to invest the resources it has. You know, and part of it is federal action. For example, on the use tax, you know, the biggest benefit to Minnesota will come from a nationwide effort on the tax simplification project and federal action saying that out-of-state vendors can collect use tax on behalf of Minnesota. And again, you know, this is a long-term strategic effort. And trying to make gains on the tax cap is going to take some time. Based on the audit data that we analyzed, we can expect to annually collect about 10% of the income tax gap, for example, and that's about $60 million through enforcement. But if we're able to make, you know, a fairly modest 5% reduction in the tax income tax gap annually through improved voluntary compliance, that may yield about $30 million. You know, so there really has to be a balance here between voluntary compliance and enforcement. So to wrap up, again, Minnesota will not collect all of the tax gap, but we think improved collection is possible. The department in the past has not had any trouble putting its compliance initiative funding to good use in good areas. They're using a sound, multifaceted approach. But within that framework, we think there are a lot of adjustments they can make in execution. And in the full copy of the report that I think you have in your folders, page 85, begins a long list of recommendations that we made, most of which are to the department. And finally, last year when we released this report, one of the issues that we talked about was trying to stabilize the department's ability to implement compliance activities. And, you know, at that time, we said we thought they needed a little bit of time to kind of tackle their turnover problems among their auditors and settle into, you know, continually ramping up compliance initiatives that they'd had for the last several biennia. I think the department at this point is ready to speak about those issues in more depth and kind of where they are now compared to where they were last year. But again, you know, I think the issue that we want to raise is that it's important to have a balanced compliance strategy and that pushing the envelope, you know, in all those different areas is something that this committee should be concerned about moving forward with revenue. So with that, if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Janon. I do have a question or two. I'm sure there's a point of diminishing returns. If the department hired twice as many auditors, that doesn't mean they're going to get twice as many dollars. It just, you know, at some point, it's throwing good money after bad. Do you have any sense whether or not we're at that point, or exceeded that point? I mean, do we have enough auditors or not enough auditors? I mean, just for the dollars we're bringing in, some of that $1 billion is not going to get collected. So how much more aggressive or less aggressive should we be? Did you get any sense of that?
Mr. Chair, actually, we did. We did some analysis looking at the productivity of auditing over the last several years, you know, up until the point we had data. And we found, in fact, you know, in our opinion, the department has not reach the point of diminishing returns. I mean, at some future point, and I couldn't tell you when,
sure,
you know, the investment may not be worth the reward, but the trend data that we analyzed said that indeed the department's not at that point yet.
Did you did mention it, but are there areas where they're spending too much time looking at and other areas that they should be looking at more? The internet sales, I think you mentioned, there's probably a lot of money in there because a lot of people buy things on eBay and over the internet, but how we can possibly collect the sales tax or do, I don't know, but are there areas where we can find a bigger pots of money than we are looking at right now?
Mr. Chair, our analysis in the use tax area, most of the use tax findings and audit assessments actually come from businesses that are buying from out of state, not from individuals. So as I said before, that the department's not investing much in individual use tax. Businesses are huge buyers of products from out of state. And I think the department's been correct in focusing its compliance efforts. So when it audits a business, it looks both at the sales tax and use tax due from that business. And we agree that that is a good focus. But I think the big bang for the buck there is going to come from the Streamlined Sales Tax Project, which is a federal effort, again, allowing out-of-state vendors to collect sales tax for Minnesota. We did find particular, on the income tax side, we did find some, and on the sales tax side, some projects that were certainly less productive over a number of years than others. And our recommendation, and that starts on page 85, was that the department redirect those resources to more productive audit activities. I don't want to discuss that too much. Some of that is not public information in terms of what the audit criteria were there, so I don't want to pinpoint specific ones, but we did make recommendations to the department in that area.
And we will be hearing from the department next on their expanded tax compliance initiatives. Are there questions of the legislative auditor? Any other questions here? Appears to be done. Well, thank you, Ms. Janod, for your...
Thank you very much.
Okay.
If you have any questions, please get in touch with me. I'd be happy to talk to each of you individually.
Thank you very much. And then we will be hearing next from the Department of Revenue on the expanded tax compliance initiatives. And Commissioner and former Commissioner, I guess, Deputy Commissioner, welcome to the Budget Division. I guess who wants to go first? Please identify yourself for the record.
Chairman, my name is Ward Ines, Acting Commissioner for the Department of the Revenue.
I'm Dan Solomone, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
Yeah. You know, Chairman, I really want to thank you for having us come here to comment on the legislative audit report and the compliance gap and the gap per se. The product they did was a high-quality product, no question about it. We have gone over it with a fine-tooth comb. We've taken their recommendations to heart. We are going to be coming forward this legislative session with a very, what we deem, very aggressive compliance initiative. And I would like just to touch on that briefly and then turn it over to Dan to talk more specifically about the auditor's report, what we've done in the last 6 months to shore up compliance presence. But we will be coming forward and coming to your committee, Chairman, to talk about an enhanced compliance initiative. And there will be a three-pronged approach. The first one is what we've done in the past is ask you guys for additional resources to hire auditors to target certain areas we think have a high yield potential. As you can see, I don't know if you can hand out this one hand up, but I have a handout here we can make available to the committee that talks about the last three compliance initiatives we've undertaken. And the legislature has been very receptive to these compliance initiatives, and they have yielded a return above what we actually expected. We did one in the 2002, 03 biennium, 04, 05, and we will be coming on 06, 07 biennium, sorry. So we've done three consecutive compliance initiatives, and as you can see from the handout, those compliance initiatives have exceeded expectations. To your point, Chairman, about diminishing returns, it's a good one. It's one we always look at. Mm-hmm. And with these compliance initiatives, it's usually a trial and error sort of thing. You take a bite, you kind of give your best guess about what you can generate out of a compliance initiative, and then you revisit that and then come back to you guys for another opportunity to pursue. At this point, there's been a little bit of a diminishing return since the very first compliance initiative in 02-03, but since that time, it's leveled off, and we expect actually to exceed our target of $90 million for the most recent compliance initiative. We expect to go over $100 million by the end of this fiscal year. So we think we can identify additional high-yield initiatives. We'll be coming to your committee, Chairman, with an initiative that we, for $10 million additional revenues, we think we can generate a net of 40. And there's a lot of, as you guys probably can glean from the legislative auditor's analysis, there's a lot of moving parts in these appliance initiatives, and one of them is the ability to secure auditors. And it's been a challenge over the years. For a while there, we were retaining auditors for about a period of a year. We would train them. They become fairly high-functioning auditors, and they get lured away by the private marketplace. Fortunately, we were able to enter into a memorandum of understanding with MAPE to allow us to give additional raises on an expedited basis in order to try to keep those auditors in-house. That has been somewhat successful. Our actual retention rate now is up to 2 years, I think. So we're able to keep them a little bit longer, and it's been very effective. Now, that memorandum of understanding is up for renewal, and we're cautiously optimistic that we'll enter into a renewal. But it's a bigger problem than just revenue. It's really a statewide problem that other agencies probably feel. But we were under some timelines that we needed to generate some revenue on these audit initiatives. So we went ahead and did a standalone deal, basically, and that's up for renewal very soon. So we hopefully will enter into another extension of that. The second piece of our compliance initiative is we'll be coming with proposals that are directly responsive to the auditor's report. And one of them that she mentioned was electronic W-2s. We think that's a good idea. We're going to be coming to you and the legislature to get approval to require electronic filing of W-2s, and that will be beneficial. The third piece is a systems upgrade. Right now, our systems are antiquated, is probably an overstatement, but there's a new integrated tax system that's available now that would be very beneficial if we were to install that to identify and locate high-yield audit opportunities. And so we'll be coming to the legislature to ask for some additional resources to implement that system. And that really is a long-term solution to enhancing compliance. Upgrading our system so we can mine data better, we can identify where the problems are, where we should be focusing our resources. So we're going to be coming forward to the legislature with a three-pronged approach, and I hope we can make some progress on this. I'm confident we can. But we want to also manage expectations. There's some people throwing around, there's a $1 billion gap out there. Can't you generate $300 million budget purposes? And I want to caution you that is probably beyond the pale for a variety of reasons we can get into more detail. But that is not a realistic expectation for this gap. It is not easy to collect. There's logistical things about even finding enough auditors, enough folks to actually go, to do the compliance initiatives. So I want to caution moderation as far as how much you can book for this upcoming budget cycle. And I will turn that over to the sure. Deputy Commissioner Salmoy to go into more detail.
Okay, go ahead.
About the audit.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you. Ward made reference to a sheet that we passed around here that shows the history of our tax compliance initiatives, and it's a high-level summary of a report you all should have received. It has a purple cover on it. It's a handy one-page summary of the highlights of that report. You'll note on the one-pager that we are in our third tax compliance initiative. The first one was given to us for the 2002-03 biennium. And you'll see there that we were given $10.3 million with a revenue goal of $60 million, actual revenue generated of $97 million, $37 million more than what was promised. We spent not quite all of the appropriation, 9.7, to get that money for an overall rate of return, revenue per dollar spent, of $10. So a 10-to-1 rate of return on that initial compliance initiative. The second one it was for the 2004-05 biennium, $12.8 million. Similar goal, about $60 million. We came in again at about 92.2. Rate of return, 7.5-to-1. So in terms of diminishing returns, I suppose the fact that it went from 10 to 7.5 is an indication that there are diminishing returns. And you would expect that in any kind of operation. But this, we need to be careful making future commitments here. In the 2006-07 biennium, the current biennium, we committed to a goal of $90.7 million with an appropriation of $17.8. We're about 82% toward that goal. We're currently at $74.6 million as of the end of November of 2006. So we're on target. We're probably on target to exceed the goal, as the commissioner mentioned. We've spent to date $9.6 million, and at least to date, the rate of return looks like 7.8 to 1. So again, a strong rate of return holding up there. I want to reiterate, though, the point the commissioner made about our expectations of tax compliance initiatives, and particularly in the light of the tax gap studies that we have done. It's important to note that we've done two tax gap studies, as was indicated in the report earlier, in the presentation earlier, one for the income tax and the other for sales. What is really important to note is that while the tax gap is a difference between what we collect and what we think people owe us, it's important to note that what we think people owe us is not based on tax returns. It's based on census data about the economy. And so we're not looking at tax returns and saying, here are people who owe us money, and we're just not getting the money. It's an academic estimate, sort of a theoretical estimate of what we would expect to collect in literally a perfect world where everyone was fully compliant. And that's why the numbers are so big. Our rate of our tax gap, by the way, is about 11% of collections. And I will note that there were only two other tax gap studies available. One was done by the state of New York. Their rate of noncompliance is higher than ours, about 14%. And the IRS did a study fairly recently, and they're coming in at about a 20% rate of noncompliance. So in terms of the limited data we have, our tax gap at least is the smallest of the three that, gap studies that have been done. And so I think we need to be careful to not assume that the $1 billion or a large percentage of it or even some significant percentage is collectible. I think we have to continue testing different strategies to see what we can do. Sort of on an incremental basis. So I wanted to be sure that that was clear.
Sarah Pappas, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and either commissioner. On the one-page chart, you mentioned revenue generated. Is that revenue collected?
Yes.
It is revenue collected. Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead. Sarah Olsen, did you have a question?
Well, I'm one of the newbies, so my question is more in regards to what's the structure of your department? Why is there an acting director now versus what's going on with the organization of your department?
Well, Commissioner, yep. Deputy Commissioner Salmon was the commissioner, and I don't know, maybe
right.
Commissioner
right.
Isaacs, can you, where
well,
were you at?
That pretty much sums it up. Well, I mean, acting may have been a maybe not an accurate assessment. I mean, I figure I'm acting until you guys confirm. The Senate needs to confirm. Okay. So, but basically, the only change in the department has been that Dan and I have changed positions, and that was a decision made between the three of us, a voluntary decision, and thought it would be best for the agency and kind of stronger suited Dan's strengths and my strengths. So basically, there hasn't been any major shakeup at the agency. It's two people changed positions, essentially. The rest of the leadership is in place, as it was under Dan, when Dan was commissioner. Other than that, there has been no changes. All the same pieces in place, other than I'm there, and Dan's there still.
Did the governor point you to the position, though? So,
what part of me?
Did the governor point you?
Yes, he did.
Okay, so.
Yes, he did.
Commissioner Isaacs would be the commissioner. He's, in the federal government, when the president can nominate somebody, but the person doesn't take the job until the U.S. Senate confirms, if it requires Senate appointment. Here it's the reverse. If the governor appoints somebody, that person continues to serve unless or until the Senate rejects the appointment, which, you know, if we never take it up, the person continues to serve. So we have a set of rules requiring us to take up the appointments within a year. So,
thanks.
So it's just different. So, okay. Commissioner Salmoni.
Just a few comments about the auditor's report. It's interesting to note that this is our first audit of our compliance program, not the initiatives, but the compliance program itself. First audit, I think, in 20 years. So I don't know if they come around every 20, but we think it was a high-quality report. We took it very seriously. We returned to the auditor at their request a very detailed list of how we're responding to each of their recommendations. They have that information. It's really our agenda for the next several years to improve our overall compliance activities. I can't stress enough two things. Number one is we have to deal with the issue dealing with the salaries of our collectors and auditors. It's very well documented that we have a very high turnover there. It was a high turnover in the first year, and now that we have had 1 year under the memo of understanding, which we entered into with the Department of Employee Relations and the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, that allowed us to give incoming new auditors a larger, put them a little higher on the scale, and then also give them increases on a more accelerated basis. That's helped a lot. It's moved the turnover problem from year one to maybe year two. We're looking at the data right now. It's also important to stress that MOU is a one-year renewable, agreement that has to be renewed if we're going to continue to have that flexibility. Long term, we simply have to take a look at that issue. Secondly, a very critical piece of doing a better job of compliance is technology. We have antiquated computer systems that have been cobbled together by the department over a number of years to get better economies and efficiency in our tax processing. But because we have been trying to get ahead of the curve to build sort of homemade computer systems internally in the department, we've gotten to the point where these old systems have reached quite a high age, and I think we're susceptible now to some of these systems failing. The vendors of some of the software are saying they will no longer support some of those systems, and we have to step back and say, how can we, if we could start over with our systems, how could we come up with a better system? Fortunately, there are some off-the-shelf tax processing programs that are now available that are so-called integrated systems, which means whether you're talking about an income tax or a corporate tax or a sales tax or any other tax, we have 28 of them. The processes, the technology, and the procedures are the same for every tax. And so whether you're working in any one of those divisions, you get trained once, and you're proficient in using the technology. States that have adopted this new integrated approach, and there have been about a dozen, are showing a good return on their investment over a period of time. And this is something that, as the commissioner noted, we are asking the legislature to help us get this new capability. I can't think of one thing that would be more effective in increasing our tax compliance than our systems upgrade. With that, perhaps, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions.
I've got a few. How many auditors do you have that we're talking about? I'm not talking
good question.
The support staff, the people who do the actual people.
About 450, I'm told.
450, okay. And about what's your percentage of turnover? Do you have any feel for what that would be? I mean, within, say, 1 year or 2 years.
It was about 30. When we measured it a year or so ago, it was about 34%.
34% within a year?
Yes.
Approximately, okay. And how long does it take to train one of them?
I'm guessing a good year.
Okay.
I should say that's about, so we lose them just about the time we finish the training. So we're running a little academy for the private sector here on auditors.
Yeah. I take all your secrets, yeah.
Pardon?
Take your secrets out to the private sector and say, here's what they're really looking for.
Yeah. Here's how you avoid it.
Go ahead.
Another issue that arises on that is that we some of our more experienced auditors spend time training the new wave of auditors, so they're not working on the real complex audits. It's probably their specialty. So it's an ongoing problem having this kind of level of turnover.
So if somebody says, well, what's the difference? If I'm being contacted, whether they've been working 1 year or 20 years, it's still going to get my attention, but it's an internal drain on your resources, what you're saying.
Okay. Absolutely.
Do you know if the governor's – I haven't seen any of the governor's budget proposals yet. Do you know if he's supporting increases in funding for the auditors or for technology? I don't know what he's proposing here.
Governor has a general 2% salary supplement in this budget.
Okay.
I think that's for all positions. There's nothing specific in the governor's budget dealing with this issue.
Okay.
And we are certainly planning to try to get our memo of understanding renewed for another year. That'll give us some breathing time.
And on the technology, I believe that he was going to be doing some stuff recommending technology, but I don't know if he was looking at your issue and recommending some money for that.
He was, and from everything we've been told is that it will be one of the highest priorities that the administration comes forward with.
Okay. Mr. Lundin, do you know what they're recommending for?
Yes, in the budget that the governor released today for the integrated tax system for the biennium, there's $16 million with $6 million going on into the tails, or $12 million into the next biennium.
That goes for what? Salary of technology or both?
That's technology.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going hardware, software, services.
Okay. Let's see. Let's start our old scene first.
It's Social Security, I believe it's 4E or 4D, has an interesting program for training child protection managers where they will give a scholarship to pay for the person's education, and then they commit to working for that agency for, you know, X number of years, however long their education plan was. Are your folks coming on as CPAs and you have to do additional training, or are they – I'm just wondering if some kind of a for the training that they receive from the department, if there couldn't be a commitment from them for a certain amount of time, because it seems like you're certainly putting a big investment in them.
It's my understanding that we're maybe the only place that they can learn how to audit the way we audit and the tax types that we have expertise in. So we are a unique training ground for auditors who return to the private sector. You know, I don't know how many of our folks are CPAs when they come in. I expect most aren't. Yeah, so a relatively small number of the overall 20% are CPAs.
I don't think you've got much bargaining power when you hire them in, just to say you have to stay for a certain length of time, right? I mean, that's the way it is. You hire them and they leave when they leave.
Yeah, you know, it's really a market-driven issue. I mean, when we got this memo of understanding in place, even though it doesn't solve the whole problem, it did make a difference. I mean, people are driven, you know, it's a dollar, it's an issue of dollars, and being able to give them a few more steps on an expedited basis did make a difference. And so it didn't solve our problem, but it helped.
I think Sarah Roebling had a question next. Did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask about the state's non-participation in the federal state electronic filing program and wondering why we are not doing that and if you've considered it.
I'm going to have Deputy Commissioner Samley comment on that.
Well, let me make clear first that we are supportive of joining the Fed-State collaboration. We have not done it to date for a number of reasons. There are some downsides that the auditor's presentation noted. One of them is they don't deal with our property tax refund returns. That's not a deal breaker, but that's one of several issues. We run the risk of reducing the turnaround time on refunds by maybe a day or two because of how they process those returns. And in the case of working family credit refunds, our lowest wage earners in Minnesota who depend on the working family credit, it could add a delay to their refund. The main concern for us is the technology that we would need to put in place in order to take advantage of the Fed-State relationship. The Feds themselves, I understand, are working on changing their computer system to what's called an XML format. This allows computers exchange of data. It's kind of a uniform electronic format. The Feds are working to have that up and running for tax year 09, which would be filing year 2010. We are planning to follow along with them on that timetable. So in a few years here, we will be fully participating in the Fed-State collaboration.
Anything further, Senator Roebling?
No,
okay, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and whatever Commissioner wants to answer. So what is the starting salary?
Good question.
For the auditor.
That is
first
a good question.
About $35,000.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, and to amplify a point the legislative auditor made, too, one of the, I guess, the enemies of compliance is complexity. And I want to tip my hat to the Senate and the House for trying to fast-track the federal conformity bill, because that is something like that will mitigate complexity in the tax code, and that will benefit compliance initiatives like ours. And allow people to be more voluntarily in compliance. So things like federal conformity, just anytime you can mitigate complexity in the tax code, that will enhance compliance. We appreciate your efforts on the federal conformity bill.
Any further questions? Okay. Well, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chairman.
Deputy Commissioner, we appreciate hearing the information, and I guess we'll be looking at other aspects down the road. Wednesday, we're going to have a Department of Finance overview of the budget recommendations made by the governor. We will also be hearing from the legislative auditor. There's two reports that are going to be released in about 45 minutes on firefighter pensions and post-retirement funds. There's also been one report already released on nonprofit grants. And I think the governor's budget does deal with something on nonprofit grants, and we may have an interest in whatever the auditor is going to be recommending on the pension funds, too. I think it's better to be ahead of the curve than behind it on that. So,
Mr. Chairman, is that the previous auditor or the current auditor?
Legislative auditor. Our auditor. Which has been the auditor since I've been here. Anything else? Okay, then we'll see you on Wednesday. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.